and welcome to the last Cory Doctorow podcast of 2010 and the last Cory Doctorow podcast for, I'm afraid, some time. As you know, if you've been following this, I'm about to head off for Christmas break, and right around the time I get back, I'm going to be getting my hip broken and my femur shaved down, and I will be offline for, I don't know, at least a month. So kind of expect me back mid-February or sometime around then. In the meantime, I'm going to pop in some podcasts from the With a Little Help audiobook. You are more than welcome to take any or all of these podcasts if you go to craphound.com/WALH and put them in your own feed. In fact, I'd be very grateful to you if you did. And on that note, the With a Little Help paperback is now $14.50 instead of $18. I figured out how to knock some money off the price with Lulu this morning. There was a problem with Lulu in that if you put an ISBN on the book, they automatically offer it for sale on Amazon, and then they want to stick in a bunch of money on top of the minimum price so that they can offer a discount through Amazon. So the long story short, the book had been priced at $15 until the moment I launched and added an ISBN to it, at which point Lulu wouldn't let me price it below about $17.80. So I figured out how to get it back down to $14.50 just in time for Christmas. Ho, ho, ho. Speaking of Christmas, I'm all done with my Christmas shopping. I'm bringing in the wrapping paper tomorrow, going to pack up the mountain of presents here in the office. And then I'm headed to Florida on Boxing Day, that for those of you who aren't in the Commonwealth, that's the day after Christmas, the 26th, to see family. My grandparents are down there. This will be their last year there after 50-some years going down. It turns out that they can't get health insurance anymore to go visit the U.S., so they're giving up their place in Florida, and they're going to be spending winters in Toronto from now on. So after a lifetime of going to Florida at Christmas to see the family, that's going to be the end of it, kind of the end of an era, really. I'm going down to Florida and going to see the family, going to take my family. Posey's coming down. My wife Alice is coming down. We're going to go to Disney World, and then we're going to come back, or I'm going to come back with the baby. Alice is going on to a social software summit in New York, and I'm going to come back with the baby, and sort of the day before my surgery, Alice gets back, and then I'm out of commission for some time. I hope your Christmas is a good one. I hope your New Year's is as spectacular as mine is shaping up to be, and I hope that nobody cracks you open and shaves your bones unless you really, really need it. So with that, I'm going to go and finish the reading of Appeals Court. This is the second of three novellas that Charlie Strauss and I will put together in the book Rapture of the Nerds, which will be out sometime in 2012, I think, from Tor Books. It's due at the end of June, anyway, June 2011. We've written two of them, Jury Service, which you've heard on this podcast, and Appeals Court, which I'm finishing today. And the third one we'll be writing starting in the new year. All right, then. Here is Appeals Court. You are charged with violating UN biohazard regulations, with wanton epidemiological disregard, with threatening the fragile peace of our world's orderly acquisition and adoption of technology, and with attempting to flee UN jurisdiction. You're out of your jurisdiction, Bonnie says. I'll get to you, the judge snaps. I never execute a criminal without offering her last words, so you can just sit tight until I call on you. Sam is thrashing hard at his golem, trying to buck it off him, but he might as well be trying to lift Glory City for all the good it does him. For Hugh, being trapped in the iron grip of a golem is oddly nostalgic, hearkening back to simpler times when he knew that he could trust his perceptions and the honest virtue of Neo-Luddism. He closes his eyes, clears his mind, and prepares to defend himself. It's bankrupt, he'll say. Your UN is a sham. There's no more virtue in your deliberation over which technologies to adopt than there is in this benighted shithole's wholesale rejection of everything that doesn't burn petrol or heretics or both. He'll say, the other side in this fight doesn't even notice it's fighting with you. Its leaders are opportunists and scoundrels. Its proponents are patsies at best and sadists at worst. Hugh sucks in air to deliver this speech that might rescue him from the gibbet, ignoring the many aches and owies that light up his body like acupuncture needles, and there is a tremendous crash, and another APC crunches down the alleyway behind the judge, its ramp falling open to reveal ranked men in white robes, numerous as ants, clutching TASP wands, scimitars, pulse guns, ballistic guns, and cruciform spears that hum with sinister energy. It's the Inquisition, Bonnie says. I told you you were out of your jurisdiction. She looks like she's ready to say more, but Sam breaks free of his golem's grip with a roar and snatches her up, flings her over his shoulder, and disappears into the guts of his APC, which clanks away amid the whining ricochets of small arms fire from the soldiers of the Inquisition. Judge Rosa's spinning turret gives the Inquisitors pause, especially after it blasts a dozen of them out of their boots. Finally, one brave soul darts forward and jams a spear tip down its barrel, falling to the ground when the judge nails him with enough electricity to freeze-dry him on the spot so that he clatters when he hits. They give up on moving her, surrounding her instead with bristling guns. "I have diplomatic immunity, you god-bothering imbeciles!" she screeches, the amplified howls knifing through their skulls and dropping a few of the remaining Inquisitors to their knees. They hustle Hugh into the APC, kicking him to the grippy deck plates and pinning him there with a gun barrel dug into one kidney. They leave a detail to watch the judge and clank away with him to the auto-de-fe. "This is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts us," one of the Inquisitors breathes right in Hugh's ear as the ramp drops in the main plaza of Glory City, where a crowd of thousands awaits his appearance. They drag him up by his much-abused arms, letting his feet scrape the ground. He loses a shoe on the way to the stage, and the other on the way up the steps. His overalls tear on the ground, so that by the time he's hauled erect before the crowd, the skin covering one whole side of his chest is abraded away, a weepy, striated road pizza left behind. A white robe is draped around him and snaps shut in behind and around his arms. The crowd roars with anticipation, and their faces swim before him, each in a rictus of savage anticipation. Hugh wishes he still believed in his god self, but they've left him his copper balaclava, so he's out of the god box. "Sinner," a voice says, hissingly, in his ear. It echoes off the walls of the plaza, off the balconies crowded with hooting spectators who fall silent when these amplified syllables are sounded. "Sinner, can you hear me?" The speaker is right there in his ear, as close as a lover, breath moist. "I can hear you," Hugh says. "Will you confess your sins and be cleansed of them before we end your life on God's earth?" "Sure," Hugh says. "Why the fuck not?" There's a disapproving murmur from the crowd, and the left side of Hugh's head lights up like someone stuck a live wire to it. A chunk of his ear falls wetly to the stage before him, and the crowd roars as the hot blood courses down his face. "You will not profane this courtroom," the hisser hisses. Hugh struggles to remember his brave speech for the judge, but it won't come. He stammers. "They're gonna kill me," he realizes, a sick certainty rising in his gorge.
"You stand accused!" the speaker shrieks in his ear. "Unclean! You have consorted with the vile demons and the skyborn minions of Satan! You did willfully escape from the custody of your arresting officer and were found in wanton congress with the degenerate scum who swirl in the cesspit of their own tumescent desires in the swamp of iniquity for which we are damned!"
His accuser's voice rises.
"Lo, these score years and eight we have dealt since the rapture, the ascent of those who are bathed in the blood of the Lamb, and what is it, you faithful among the fallen, ask? What is it that holds us back to this land of sorrows? And I answer you, it is the likes of this miserable sinner. Behold the man, lost in the sorrow and the degradation of his evil."
Hugh manages to stay silent while the Inquisitor gets himself worked up in a holy roller frenzy of foaming denunciation. It would appear that Hugh has single-handedly doomed every living human on the North American continent to a fiery and perpetual damnation by his pursuit of sins, both trivial and esoteric, from sodomy to simony, by way of barratry and antimony. Concentration is hard. He's weak at the knees, and the entire side of his head feels as if it's been dipped in molten lead. He listens to the condemnation with mounting disbelief, but not even the accusation of ministering iced tea enemas to ailing baby ground squirrels in the petting zoo managed to drag a protest from him in the face of likely punishment. He can see the score to the scene, and his words would merely serve as punctuation for random acts of degradation and violence against his person. Finally, the Inquisitor winds down, his voice ratcheting into a gloating hiss.
"How do you plead, sinner?"
"Does it make any difference?" Hugh asks in the sudden silence, hating the tremor in his voice. "You're going to kill me anyway." The small of his back explodes, and he falls over, unable to draw breath with which to scream.
Dimly, he registers a couple of shadowy figures standing over him, one of them having just clubbed him in the kidneys.
How do you plead, sinner?
Hugh isn't about to plead anything because he can barely breathe, but the Inquisitor seems to view this as deliberate recalcitrance. He raises a hand and another guard step forwards and clubs Hugh between the legs.
How does he plead? Anyone?
The Inquisitor roars at the crowd, hidden amplifiers boosting his voice and scattering it across the plaza like shotgun blasts.
Guilty! Guilty! Guilty!
Roars the crowd. The prosecution, having made its case before God and man, rests, says the Inquisitor, leaning heavily on a baseball bat. Hugh is distantly conscious of another, more thoughtful voice. And what do you say, Minister for the Defense?
Nothing to say, Your Grace.
The defense attorney's voice is thin and reedy and quavers a little.
My client is obviously guilty of sin.
Then I guess we are in agreement. Okay, y'all, let justice be done. Guards pick Hugh up off the ground and bear him to the front of the stage. In the name of the authority vested in me by the law of the Lord as bishop of this principality, I hereby find you guilty of whatever the hell you're guilty of. We don't get to give justice. That's his upstairs' job. So the sentence of this court, handed down in mercy rather than in anger, is that we are going to give you a one-way ticket to ask the Holy Father for clemency and forgiveness in person. To Heaven's Gate. The crowd roars its approval, and people begin to stream out of the square like ants, boiling and shifting to repel an invasion of their territory. Hugh groans, gasps for air, and coughs up blood. It won't hurt, the judge promises, almost kindly. Not much, anyway. There's another brief journey by APC, this time barely out of the square and back round a couple of the side roads. The guards let Hugh lie on a bench seat, which is a mercy because his legs aren't working so well. Just get it over with, he wishes dismally. Is anyone going to tell Sandra, he wonders. She got me into this. The APC parks up and the ramp rumbles down. They're in another of the huge access tunnels that run through the wall of the dome, like the one Doc and Sam dragged him in through almost a day ago. It's been a very long day. The longest. Vast, blast-proof doors close behind the APC, slamming shut with a thunderous boom. The guards frog march Hugh down the ramp and out, up the tunnel to the next set of doors. There's another APC behind the one he arrived in, and a handful of dignitaries step out of it to witness the proceedings. The guard on his left lets go of him. When the doors open, run forward, he says. If you dance and stamp your feet a bit, they'll figure out where you are faster. They know they're going to be fed, though, so they'll be waiting for you. If you make them come inside, they'll take their time. You're going to feed me to the ants, he realizes. God's little helpers, says the guard to his right. What if I won't cooperate? Hugh asks woozily. The guard on his left hefts his cattle prod thoughtfully. Then we'll have to work you over some more and do it again. He hefts the prod in Hugh's direction. Not that it's any trouble, mind. All the same to us. Hugh backs away from the guards until he thumps into the outer door of the airlock. Oh, shit. The guards are wearing hermetically sealed tupper suits. So are the official witnesses. A bell clangs from the front APC, then the door he's leaning against begins to grind down into the ground. Hugh glances round and sees the guards and witnesses scurrying backwards to the safety of their armored vehicles, despite the security of their ant-proof suits.
Fucking cowards!
He tries to yell, but it comes out as a cracked squawk. Damn, I'm gonna die and I don't even get a good exit line. He turns back to face the opening door and takes a step forward towards the blasted wilderness that used to be North America. It's like the surface of the moon, or worse. A lightning strike somewhere up the coast has set one of the petrochemical forests on fire, and the resulting smog bank has smeared the baby blue bowl of the sky with the sooty muck of a bygone age. The sun itself is a bloated red torch aflame in a sea of shit-colored clouds that roil and bubble above a landscape the color of charred ash. Gas trees march into the distance from the flanks of the Glory City Dome, but the ground beneath them is a muddy brown and it shimmers slightly. At first, Hugh thinks it's covered in a slick of escaping light fraction crude, but then he looks closer and sees that the shimmer is that of motion, the incessant febrile ratcheting digestive action of a myriad of superorganisms. The ants are lord of all they survey, and that includes him.
Hugh steps forward onto the desolate ground, leaving the tunnel mouth. He glances round once. Bastards, he mouths at the smugly merciful bishop and his torturers, safe in their air-conditioned tanks. There's a faint, rattling, humming noise in the air, and he takes a deep breath, wondering how long it'll take the ants to notice him. What chance does he have of reaching another airlock? Probably not much. They wouldn't be using this as an established means of execution if survival was easy, or even possible. But Hugh has no intention of giving the assholes in the dome the satisfaction of actually seeing the ants get him. He takes another deep breath and lurches forward. One knee is very much worse for wear, and he's lightheaded and nauseous from the beating he's taken, trying to get away from the front of the airlock. Hugh? At first he thinks he's hallucinating. It's Bonnie's voice, tinny and distant, and that grinding, rasping noise is back. There's also a faint sizzling sound, like hot fat on a grill. He shakes his head and lurches on. The sizzling noise is back. The ground ahead is dark like an oil spill. Hugh, where are you? Hang on! He stumbles to a halt. The oil slick is spreading like a shadow, and when he looks round, he sees that it extends between him and the dome. That's odd. He looks down. Ants. They're everywhere. He can't outrun them, so he collapses to his knees and looks at them. They're what's making the sizzling noise. It's the noise of a trillion millimeter-wide cutting machine mouths chowing down on the universe. If they could speak their message, it would be, "You will be assimilated." He reaches out one shaky hand, and a winged ant alights on his fingertip. He brings it close to his face, ignoring the scattering of fiery bites on his legs and knees, trying to meet the eyes of his executioner. The ant stares at him with CCD scanners. It spreads its wings, and Hugh watches, entranced, trying to read the decals embossed on each flight surface. Chitin is waxy, isn't it? He realizes. It would dissolve in the gasoline mangroves, so these aren't... Hugh, hang on, we'll rescue you! It is Bonnie's voice, he realizes, looking round in disquiet. Massively amplified, it booms out across the wasteland from the top of a vehicle that looks like an old-fashioned swamp boat with a bulbous plastic body mounted on it. The boat is surfing over the ants, he thinks, until he realizes there's not much of a solid surface over there. Can you hear me? Bonnie yells. Hugh waves. Great. I'm going to pop the hatch and lay down an insecticide screen. When you see it go, I want you to run this way. 3, 2, 1, bang! One end pops off the side of the swamp boat, and a cloud of foam drifts out. Bonnie follows it, something like a flamethrower strapped to her back. She's pumping away in all directions, striding toward him and his little raised island, and Hugh realizes that nothing, nothing has ever looked as beautiful to him as this pansexual post-human, lithe and brilliant in her skin-tight neoprene suit, laying about her with grace and elegance and GABA inhibitors as she comes to rescue him from this frankly insane situation. Hugh lurches into motion, a drunken and lopsided wobble impelled by a now fiery burn across the side of his face. The ants have tasted blood, and they're hungry. He howls as he runs, and Bonnie steps aside and spritzes him on the fly. Go on, she calls, I'll cover you! He needs no urging, but lurches on toward the swamp boat rescue. Within the back of the translucent bubble, he can dimly see a figure. Sam, maybe? Working the controls, keeping the big blower on the back of the boat in ceaseless motion, sucking ants through the mincing blades. He's on the ground, and he can't remember how he got there. Shit, this is no good, says Bonnie. What have they done? Oh, fuck. She picks him up and begins to drag him, her breath coming in gasps. The ants see their prey escaping and close in, an ominous, sizzling hymn of destruction on the wing. Go on, she urges, and Hugh manages to get one leg working. They hop along together, and Bonnie gives him an enormous shove, boosting him up the side of the boat and in through the airlock. The open lock bay is crawling with fiery red ants, the disassembler toolkits on their heads whining in an iridescent blur. Hugh bats at them, and Bonnie stands up just outside the airlock to spritz down the swamp boat, and then something like a monstrous humming tornado falls on her with an audible thud. She screams once and twitches, and Hugh cowers at the back of the airlock. Fuck! The door he's lying against crashes backwards under him, tumbling over him in the swamp boat as Sam leaps over his body and dives forward. Bonnie! With the last of his strength, Hugh grabs one of Sam's ankles, tumbling him into the lock. Stop! He gasps. Bonnie! Sam howls, but he freezes instead of throwing himself into the gray storm. Close the door, we're both dead, Hugh gasps. Bonnie! One meaty hand reaches out, then closes on the airlock panel. Oh god, oh shit!
There's a bonnie-shaped outline just visible on its feet through the whirlwind, but it's glowing white, the color of live bone, and something tells Hugh he's looking at her skeleton, crucified on a storm of insectoid malice in the act of rescuing him from the swarm. They'll be waiting for you, and Sam swings the door shut with a boom on its gaskets, just as the pile of white bones at the heart of the tornado explodes outwards and collapses across the wasteland in front of the airlock. They're not out of danger. Sam howls and grabs at his face, falling backwards against the opposite wall of the airlock. Spray! He yells, like a dying desert explorer calling for water. Hugh fumbles around the cramped cell, squishing bugs wherever he finds them, until he sees the blue spray bottle strapped to one wall. He hauls himself upright and takes aim at Sam. Where do you want it? He asks. Sam half turns toward Hugh and holds his hands out from his face. Hugh retches and holds the trigger down, blasting Sam in what's left of the front of his head. The ant tornado that came down on Bonnie must have shed waves of flying, biting deconstructors, and Sam's head hosts a boiling pit of destruction, cheeks bitten through and eye sockets seething. The noises Sam makes are piteous but coherent enough that Hugh is sickly afraid that the man's going to survive. And after what happened with Bonnie, he's not sure what that means. Oh, God, Sam gurgles, and Hugh yanks down the emergency first aid kit and pulls out a gel pack that says something about burns and bites and massive tissue injuries on its side. He lays it across the top of Sam's face, making sure to leave a hole around his mouth, and hunts out a serrette full of something morphine-esque and whacks it onto Sam's upper arm. After a tense minute, Sam's whistling breaths slow and the shuddering spasms relax into something like sleep. Hugh is nearly out of it by this time, drunk on a cocktail of terror, pity, pain, and exhaustion. The world seems to be spinning as he hauls himself through the rear door and into the cockpit at the back of the craft. Smuggler swamp boat, he realizes. Doc must have not wanted to show this anywhere near Glory City. As he studies the unfamiliar controls, he comes to the unpleasant conclusion that he's not going anywhere on his own. Don't know how to operate it, and if I did, I wouldn't know where to go, he realizes. He glances out the windshield at the gathering darkness, punctuated by the evil, fire-red bellies of ants that are trying their luck on the diamond-reinforced sapphire laminate. Some of them are even leaving gouges in it. Just a temporary reprieve. There's a crackle from the grill on the dash.
Ready to accept UN jurisdiction, you miscreant?
Croaks a familiar tenor. Hugh stares at the speaker as floodlights come on behind him in the depths of the swamp, spearing the cab of the smuggler's boat with a blue-white glare.
Or would you rather I crack that toy open like an egg and leave you to the ants?
Christ, Hugh thinks. It's not as though I know how to drive this goddamn thing anyway. He presses a button next to the grill. Can you hear me? He says. He repeats this with four more likely-looking buttons until Judge Judy's cackle answers him back.
You gonna come along peacefully?
Sure looks like it, he says. Do I get to stand trial somewhere civilized? The judge chuckles fatalistically.
Once we shoot our way off this fucking continent and nuke it in our wake, I fully intend to drag your spotty ass back to Libya for a proper trial. Does that suit you?
Down to the ground, Hugh says. Now what?
Hero,
Aid says, popping out of his lantern after the judge has Hugh shrink-wrapped and tossed in a narrow hold, her Dalek suit and her golems filling up all the available on Sam's boat.
Ew, he says, when he catches sight of Sam's rune of a face.
That can't be good. He'll get fixed up once he gets to civilization, Hugh says. Judge is taking us to Libya. He sighs and tries to get comfortable in his enforced, plastic-wrapped vermicularitude. The ants got Bonnie, he adds conversationally, his voice hollow and echoing in the cramped hold.
You don't say, Aid says. Well, that's too bad. Scratch one useful idiot.
You know, it's going to be a pleasure to rat you out to the UN, Hughes says. A pleasure to get the ambassador cut free and fed to a disassembler. Your movement stinks. The tiny Adrian plants its hands on its hips and cocks its head at Hugh. Useful idiots I have patience for, he says. Useless idiots, well, that's something else altogether. The boat jutters to a halt. There's a roar of jets overhead and a series of crashes all around them.
We're being bombed, Hugh thinks.
The boat bounces like a pea on a plate. Sam, are you conscious yet? He says aloud. Sam doesn't move. Just as well, he thinks, and prepares to die.
Oh, please spare me the drama, Adrian says. I radioed your position to the bishop so that he could capture you, not kill you. The ambassador needs a host. He hears the golem slam past his hold and rush out to do battle, then more jouncing crashes.
I have diplomatic immunity!
The judge screeches as something drags her past his cell. A moment later, the hatch opens, and Hugh and Sam are lifted, dumped into a gigantic airtight hamster ball, sealed, and rolled away toward Glory City.
Children, the bishop says. He is thin and weak-chinned and watery-eyed, and his voice is familiar.
It takes Hugh a moment to place it, and then he remembers the voice, moist in his ear.
Sinner, can you hear me?
You are in so much trouble!
Judge Judy is no longer hissing like a tea kettle, but her rage is still barely controlled.
What do the words diplomatic immunity mean to you?
Not an awful lot, we're afraid, the bishop says, and witters a little laugh. We don't much go in for formalities here in the New World, you know.
They've amputated the Dalek suit's gun and damped its public address system so that Judge Judy is reduced to a neutered head in a pepper mill with a black robe of office draped round it, but she is still capable of giving looks that could curdle milk. Hugh numbly watches her glare at the bishop and the bishop's watery answering stare.
What shall we do with you? The bishop says. Officially, you're dead. Which is convenient, since it wouldn't do to have the great unwashed discover that God's will was apparently to let you go.
The entity who alerted us to your presence was adamant that the sinner here should be spared. You're host to some god vomit that many entities are interested in, and consequently, you may live. So chin up, all right?
I'm thrilled, Hugh says, but I expect that means Sam here's not going to live, nor the judge.
Sam is zap-strapped at the ankles and wrists and shoulders and knees and thighs, but it's mostly a formality. He's barely breathing, and the compress on his face blooms with a thousand blood-colored roses.
Well, of course not, the bishop says. Heretics, enemies of the state. They're to be shoved out the lock as soon as we're sure that they've got nothing of interest to impart to us. A day, two tops. Got that, Your Honor? As long as you say useful things, you live.
The judge sputters angrily in her pepper mill.
Now, let's get you off to the operating theater, the bishop says.
Hugh can barely muster the will to raise an eyebrow at this.
Operating theater? Yes, we found that quadruple amputees are much more pliable and less apt to take it on the lam than the able-bodied. You'll get used to it. Trust us.
The servants of the Inquisition, ranged all around them, titter at this.
Take them away, the bishop says, waving a hand.
Hugh is having a dream. He's a disembodied head whose vocal cords thrum in three-part harmony with a whistle lodged in his stump of a throat. The song is weird and familiar, something he once sang to a beautiful girl, a girl who gave her life for him. The song is all around him, sonorous and dense, a fast demodulation of information from the cloud high above, his truncated sensorium being transmitted to the curious heavens. The song is the song he sang to the beautiful girl, and she's singing back. His eyes snap open. He's on the floor of his cell, parched dry and aching, bleeding and naked. The whistle warbles deep in his throat and the floor vibrates in symphony with the tromping of a trillion tiny feet and the scissoring of a trillion sharpened mouthparts. The ants come up through the floor and Hugh squirms away from them as best as he can, but he's still shrink-wrapped and the best he can do is hump himself inchworm-style into a corner pressed up against the wall of the dome that forms the outer wall of his cell. The song pours out of his throat, unabated by his terror. Some part of him is surprised that he's capable of caring about anything anymore, but he does not want to be eaten by the ants, does not want to be reduced to a Hugh-shaped lump of brick-red crawling insects. The whistle's really going to town now. The ambassador is having words with the hypercolony, and Hugh can just barely make out the sense of the song he's singing.
Ready for upload.
The ants have covered him, covered the walls and the floor and the ceiling, and they've eaten through his coating of shrink-wrapped, but the expected stings don't come. Instead, Hugh is filled with the sense of vast clumps of information passing through his skin, through the delicate mucous membranes of his eyes and nostrils, through his ears and the roots of his hair, all acrawl with ants whose every step conveys something.
Something. The totality of the hypercolony, its weird, sprawling consciousness, an emergent phenomenon of its complexity, oozing through his pores and through the ambassador and up into
the cloud. It's not just the ants either. It's everything they've ever eaten, everything they've ever disassembled. Somewhere in that stream is every building, every car, every tree and animal, and every person the ants have eaten, have disassembled. Bonnie is passing through him, headed for the cloud. Well, she did always want to upload.
Hugh doesn't know how long the ambassador holds palaver with the hypercolony, only knows that when the song is done, he is so hoarse he can barely breathe. During a duet, do the musicians pay any attention to the emotional needs of their instruments? Hugh leans against the wall, throat raw as the ambassador chatters to the ant colony, biological carriers for the engines of singularity, its own ancestral bootstrap code, and he can just barely grasp what's going on. There are complex emotions here, regret and loss and irony and schadenfreude and things for which human languages hold no words, and he feels very stupid and very small as he eavesdrops on the discourse between the two hive minds, which is, when the chips are down, a very small discourse, for the ambassador doesn't have enough bandwidth to transmit everything the ants have ever stored. It's just a synchronization node, the key that allows the hypercolony to talk to the cloud in orbit, high above it. And Bonnie is still dead, for all that something that remembers being her is waking up upstairs, and he's still lying here in a cell waiting to be chopped up by barbarians, and there's something really weirdly wrong with the way he feels in his body, as if the ants have been making impromptu modifications, and as the ambassador says goodbye to the ants, a sense of despair fills him. The door opens. Hello, my child. It's the other bishop, the pansexual pervert in the polygenital suit. It winks at him. Expecting someone else? Hugh tries to reply. His throat hurts too much for speech just yet, so he squirms up against the wall, trying to get away, for all the time an extra millimeter will buy him. Oh, stop worrying, the bishop says indulgently. I just dropped by to say everything's sorted out. Mission accomplished, I gather. The, Puritans are holed up upstairs, watching a fake snuff video starring yourself being disassembled for spare organs. Operating theaters make for great cinema, and provide a good reason for not inviting them to the Auto de Fe in person. Isn't CGI great? Which means you're mostly off the hook now, and we can sort out repatriating you. Huh? Hugh blinks, unsure what's going on. Is this a setup? He wonders. But there's no reason why the lunatics would run him through something like this, is there? It's so weird, it's got to be true. What do you mean? He coughs horribly. His throat is full of something unpleasant and thick, and his chest feels sore and bloated. We're sending you home, the bishop says patiently. It holds up a slim hand and snaps its fingers. A pair of hermaphrodites in motley suits with bells on the tips of their pointy shoes steer in a wheelchair and go to work on Hugh's bonds with electric shears and a gentle touch. You have our thanks for a job well done. I'd beatify you, except it's considered bad form while the recipient is still alive, but you can rest assured that your lover is well on her way to being canonized as a full saint in the First Church of the Teledildonic. Giving up her life so that you might survive to bring the hypercolony into the full grace of the cloud certainly would qualify her for beatification, even if her other actions weren't sufficient, which they are as it happens. Slim hands lift Hugh into the wheelchair and wheel him through the door. I feel weird, Hugh says, voice awed in his ears. His ears? He manages to look down and whimper slightly. Yes, that's often one of the symptoms of beatification, the bishop says placidly. The transgendered occupy a special place of honor in our communion, and to have it imposed on you by the hypercolony is a special sign of grace. And Hugh sees that it's true, but he doesn't feel as upset about it as he knows he ought to. The ants have given him a whole goddamn new body while the ambassador was singing a duet with him, and he, she, is about 5 years younger, 5 centimeters shorter, and if her pubes are anything to go by, her hair is going to come in 2 shades lighter than it was back when she was a man. It's one realization too many, so Hugh zones out as the bishop's minions wheel her up the corridor and into an elevator while the bishop prattles on. The explanation that the bishop is both the leader of the church temporal, the fallen Baptists, and the church transcendental, the polyamorous perverts, passes him by. There's some arcane theological justification for it all, references to Zoroastrian dualism, but in her depression and disorientation, the main thing that's bugging Hugh is the fact that she survived, and Bonnie didn't. Upstairs in whatever dwelling they're in, there's a penthouse suite furnished in sybaritic luxury. carpets of silky, natural growing hair, wall-hanging screens showing views from the landscapes of imaginary planets, and the obligatory devotional orgy beds and sex crucifixes of the Church of Teledildonics. The bishop leads the procession in through a door, and a familiar voice squawks,
"You'll regret this!"
Perhaps. The bishop is calm, and Hugh sees why fairly rapidly. Judge Giuliani spins her chair around and glares at him, then her eyes fasten on the wheelchair.
"What happened here?" she demands.
"The alien artifact you so urgently seek," the bishop says with heavy irony. "It has accomplished its task, and we are blessed by the fallout. Its humble human vessel, who you see before you," a hand caresses Hugh's shoulder, "is permanently affected by the performance, and we are deeply relieved." "Its task?" Juliana's aghast. "Are you insane? You let it out?" "Certainly," the bishop smirks, "and we are all the better for it." He pauses for a moment, sneezes convulsively, then shudders orgasmically. Oh, that was good. Oh my, yes. Oh. The cloud has reestablished its communion with the North American continent, and I feel sure that the hypercolony is deeply relieved to have offloaded almost 2 decades worth of uploads, everything that happened since the rapture of the nerds, in fact. Ah, Giuliani glares at the bishop, then gives it up as a bad job. The bishop doesn't intimidate easily.
"Who's this?" she demands, staring at Hugh.
"This? Don't you recognize her?" the bishop simpers. "She's your creation, after all. And you're going to take very good care of her, aren't you?"
"Gack!"
says Hugh, blanching. She tries to lever herself out of the wheelchair, but she's still as weak as a baby.
"If you think I'm..."
A puzzled expression crawls over the judge's face.
"Why?" she demands.
She peers closer at Hugh and hisses to herself,
You little rat bastard! Court is in session!"
Because the ambassador she carries is the main pacemaker for all uploads from the North American continent, and if you don't look after her, the cloud will be very pissed off with you, and so will the hypercolony. Oh, and if you don't promise to look after her, you aren't going home. Is that good enough for you?
Ahem, says Giuliani.
She squints at Hugh, eyebrows beetling evilly. Main pacemaker for a whole continent? Is that true? Hugh nods, unable to trust her throat. Giuliani clears her throat.
Then, goddammit, I hereby find you not guilty of everything in general and nothing in particular. All charges are dismissed.
She glares at the bishop. I'll even get her enrolled in the witness resettlement program. Will that do for now? Hugh shudders, but the bishop nods agreeably. Yes, that will be sufficient, he says condescendingly. Just remember, you wouldn't want the hypercolony to come calling, or crawling, would you? The judge nods, meek submission winning over her bubbling rage. Very well. There appears to be a jet with diplomatic clearance on final approach into Charleston right now. Shall we go ahead and put you on it? Halfway across the Atlantic, Hugh falls into a troubled sleep, cuddled restlessly in a first-class berth. Sitting up front in ambassador class, the judge mutters darkly to herself, occasionally glancing nervously over her shoulder in the direction of Hugh and her passenger. Far above them, the cloud whirls in its orbit, tasting the meat with its multifarious sensory apparati, thinking its ineffable thoughts, muttering in RF and gravity and eigenstate. Now it's got someone to talk to downstairs, signals synchronized by the beat of Hugh's passenger, it grows positively voluble, catching up with the neighborhood gossip, chuckling and chattering about the antics of those lovable but dim dreaming apes who remain below. Hugh's dreaming that she's back at Sandra Lal's house in the aftermath of that memorable party that started the whole thing off. Only she's definitely she, wearing her new body, aware of it but comfortable in it at the same time. She's in the kitchen, chewing over epistemology with Bonnie. A sense of sadness spills over him, but Bonnie laughs at something, waving. Bonnie is male this time, at the window. Then he holds out his hand to Hugh. Hugh walks into his embrace and they hold each other for a long time. Bonnie doesn't say anything, but his question is clear in Hugh's head as she leans her chin in his shoulder. Not yet, Hugh says sleepily. I'm not ready for that. Not till I've kicked AIDS Bud halfway into orbit and cleared it with the judge. They're making you a saint. Did you know that? Bonnie nods and makes a weird, warbling sing-song noise in the back of her throat. It soothes Hugh, and she can feel an answering song rising from the ambassador. No, don't worry about me, Hugh murmurs. I'll be all right. We'll get together sometime. I just have some loose ends to tie up first. And the funny thing is that even inside her dream, she believes it. Well, all right then, gang. That is the last podcast of 2010. I'll speak to you from the other side of my surgery sometime in February, would be my guess. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful holiday and a wonderful Christmas. And thank you, John, my intrepid editor, for a year's worth of totally awesome and kick-ass podcast editing. I hope you all will join me in thanking John for this amazing work that he's done for us. Thank you. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.